Welcome to Life Lab, hosted by David Ponder and Zach Schaefer, where we inspire listeners to live the good life through organic conversations about evergreen topics.
Life Lab captures our belief in personal evolution and a growth mindset. So,
experiment with life.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
So I was thinking today about something that happened over the summer. We were on a hike. I was on a hike with Dylan and Marin, and we came across a trail, and there was a bridge, and the bridge looked perfectly like stable, but the rails on the side had these big openings on them. And I looked at Dylan and Marin, and I just know how rambunctious they are, and I could see they could easily fit through those. They could easily squeeze through them. And for a minute, I thought, okay, we're turning around. This hike was good enough. We don't need to do this, you know. But then I decided, no, you know what? We're here to hike. I want to have this experience. And so I decided to take him across it. But I held on to Dylan very tightly because he's rambunctious, right? So I was thinking about that this morning. And I was glad that I made that decision. I was glad that we actually did do that. But there was that moment of danger there where I almost didn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Danger is the topic of the day.
It is.
I think it's a cool topic because it is all around us and can infect people to different degrees. Is how I think about it. I think of it almost like a virus, how people interact with the concept of danger.
Yeah, the simple definition that I found when I looked it up was the possibility of suffering harm or injury. And I would just broaden that and just say negative consequences, right?
Potential negative consequences. So how do you differentiate danger from risk then as a risk professional?
Yeah, I was thinking that through. I still need to evaluate my thoughts because we talk about risk all the time. And the way that I think about risk is something that I learned back from the old Ernst & Young days. It's like a what could go wrong. That's another way of thinking about a risk.
So basically you're in a business that could be called danger management, but they're just choosing to call it risk management.
Yeah, these risks, though, generally in my business, we're talking about financial loss, okay, which, you know, you could say it's still a danger.
Those are huge negative consequences.
It's a negative consequence. I know, that's why I broadened it from, like, injury or harm, this definition.
Financial injury and financial harm.
Okay. I can buy that. One of the things that I would say, when you're talking about risk, you're talking about something that could or could not occur, and you're trying to assign a probability to it to avoid a loss event, right? To avoid the injury and or harm.
So with your bridge example, the potentiality is Dylan going through the planks. I don't know. I don't have a ruler on me to measure Dylan's size. I can only do a gut response as to whether he'll dart through it and dive off the bridge, and the loss would be Dylan dying.
All right. So if we're going to do this, here we go. you're carrying me down the dang.
No, but I'm just saying yeah. It is. No. To me, they're very similar.
They are. They're very similar. I was trying to come up with an argument of why they're different. If I'm gonna try to put that stake in the ground, we'll revisit it. But then I'm gonna relent to what you're doing. Just give me a second. The stake in the ground would be danger is an element of extreme high risk, more focused towards bodily injury
death,
and harm,
yeah.
Death. But if we're gonna go down the risk, because this all applies. So when I was talking about that bridge scenario, this is a very good way to illustrate what you do in risk management and businesses. You say, okay, there's a situation where risk is elevated beyond my risk tolerance, okay? So people don't think about this, but we're accepting risk all the time. Being alive
is risk.
Is risky. You know, you can die in your sleep just from a heart attack. You can die because you ate a hamburger, you know, but you still ate that hamburger. And you will eat more hamburgers probably, even though you know that there's a tiny risk that is elevating every time you eat that hamburger, potentially, from what you've heard about heart disease, right? So we're always accepting risk. And we have this tolerance level where we're uncomfortable above that tolerance level, right? And businesses do this as well if they're managing their risk well. So then that situation where I come across the bridge and I realize there's an instance of risk that's beyond my risk tolerance, right? That's why I felt uncomfortable.
Yeah. That's why you grabbed him.
Otherwise, we just would have walked across the bridge, would have been fine. Wouldn't even thought about it. Would have been business as usual. So that was one of my risk findings. I had a risk finding. Oh, man, what am I going to do about this? Now, there are ways to deal with that. These in business, they call these risk treatments, right? And there's four risk treatments. You can either accept the risk, just move forward anyway. You can try to transfer that risk, right? Let's see if somebody else goes across the bridge, how their kids do with it, right? Or I don't want to do this myself, right? I don't want myself to get injured, so I'll let someone else go across the bridge. Something like that. Typically in business, it's insurance or something like that. Mm-hmm. I can mitigate the risk, right? So I'm going to build the rails. There's no rails there. I'm going to take the time to build
hold
the rails,
his hand,
right? Yeah, that's so that would be called a control. And then not doing that, like, because that would be the primary way to fix that risk, because that was what my initial perceived risk was. Then there would be a compensating control, which is holding on to him tightly. So I did the compensating control thing. I didn't fix the initial risk that I saw, but I put in a compensating measure to try to lower the risk to get myself comfortable with it. So there's the mitigate, right? What did we do? We did accept. Avoid.
Don't go across.
There you go.
So is that what you just – first of all, thank you. I think that's a good breakdown. Mm-hmm. Is that what your brain actually does in that scenario, or do you just instinctually grab him?
No, I just grab him.
So that's the difference between System 1 and System 2 thinking. System 2 thinking from the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, who, again – my top three books of all time. He won the Nobel Prize in economics, and he's not an economist. It's never happened before. He's a psychologist. But System 1 thinking is danger. You use your senses. That's primal. It's animal. It's instinct. It's gut. There's something wrong. He grabs Dylan. System 2 thinking is what he just walked us through. That's taking a framework of intelligence and principles and applying it to specific use cases that can then cut across an entire genre of potential danger scenarios, if you will. But that's hard. But we're hardwired to jump right into System 1 thinking, and that's because of evolution. Because the dangers we used to face were animals or other tribes, and they still are to a degree on the human side.
Because those who went to System 2 first died.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's why our System 1 thinking is easier to slide into, because it has kept the species alive longer.
That's right.
But as we have to live in a civilized society close to other people's System 2 thinking has gained prominence, but that's harder because it's more deliberate and takes a ton of effort. It literally burns more energy, cognitive calories, doing that.
That makes sense. I'm looking at an infographic, and it talks about some elements of System 1 thinking. System 1 thinking continuously scans our environment. It is fast but error prone. Mm-hmm. It works automatically and effortlessly via shortcuts, impulses, and intuition.
Absolutely. It's all heuristics, and that's where our biases really can seep in there. I mean, there's just so much to unpack with danger. I'm going to sound like a real conspiracy theorist for most of this one.
All right.
Which is not my goal. I think people in power, with large amounts of power, specific government power, and not just U.S. government. Any human who is charged with either writing the rules that control other humans or enforcing them in a small group of people having control over what gets decided, man, they can use danger as a tool.
They do use danger as a tool.
Because they're never going to let a good crisis go to waste. So they really need to make sure crises are always being stirred up and people are embracing that fear and turning to them to solve things for them.
So that's a rabbit hole, and let's go down it. But before we do, I want to say one thing. I want to wrap up.
You say
Can I wrap up
wrap
my
it
piece?
Up.
Okay. So I'm going to continue that stake in the ground and say danger is different than risk.
I'm not saying they are the same.
If not, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'll change my mind later. But just for the context of this conversation, let's say that I'll put that stake in the ground. And I'll say it this way. In risk management and business, what are we doing? We're doing system two thinking. There's never a time in my business where I'm scanning the environment, trying to notice if something's happening and just reacting on intuition and gut. And I would say that does happen in business. There are crisis situations that happen in business in moments where, you know, shoot, you can see what's happening right now with the collapse of FTX. Were they the largest cryptocurrency exchange?
Second largest.
They were something like $25 billion company or something like that?
$32
billion company. Poof, gone. So you can imagine there's some danger and there's probably some system one thinking from people who their business is going to go under because FTX was their bank, their creditor, their lender. They had loans.
It's
going to
be the largest bankruptcy case in the history of the United States.
So you can I guarantee there's some system one thinking going on there. But even in those situations, it probably transitions quickly to system two in business. So that's what I'm going to stick my stake in the ground and say. The difference between like risk management, especially from a business perspective, and danger, what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
okay. I'll buy that. Okay. System one, danger. System two, risk. Sure.
Okay.
But yeah, I think crisis. Okay, so what – I'm going to go right to my foundation. So for me, the foundation of danger and an individual's response to it to keep themselves safe is all about trust. Can I trust myself, my senses, my intuition, my instincts, my gut reaction to situations to keep myself and my family safe? Or in the larger society that we now live in, can I trust the authorities, the experts, the media, the things I'm reading to be accurate, timely, and in my best interest to keep me safe? I will always lean towards option A. I will always lean towards what my instincts say, and I won't be gaslit by what others want me to believe.
Here's some context that I think is important to add to that. So stick with that thought. So there are mental shortcuts we take during this system one thinking, right? Those involve intuition, which is the ability to understand something immediately without the need for conscious reasoning. Mm-hmm. So just like you said, can I trust myself? Can I trust my intuition? What's my gut telling me? Mm-hmm. What's my gut reaction? Heuristics, which are mental shortcuts to problem solving and learning based on previous experience, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, shoot, this happened and I remember that. So if I avoid that, I'll probably be good.
Yeah, it's a shortcut.
Not always reliable,
right?
But based on previous experience. And then framing. And that's just the whole collection of anecdotes, stereotypes that make us feel the way that we feel, drive our emotions, give us our biases, the things that we try to rely to understand and respond to the world. So in what you're talking about, can I trust myself or do I need to look outside to authority? I think that those three things all have a role that they play when you're making that decision.
Well, yeah, 100%. And I'm not saying my decisions are accurate and capital T truth and not flawed. Quite the opposite. The main point Kahneman makes that pissed everyone off was humans are reliably inconsistent, inaccurate, but it doesn't mean what we're doing is bad. It just means that it's not necessarily always objective, and we create system two frameworks, systems, and principles to retrospectively rationalize all our actions and thoughts and clean them from system one. He says his whole point is, folks, humans aren't rational actors. We are irrational actors consistently and reliably across all spheres in our life.
Mm-hmm. So as long as – I would say this. And this might be something that continues to feed our bias for safety and all that stuff. As long as the what could go wrong doesn't happen, right? So that's like criteria one. And then criteria two, we can tell a story about why we made the right decision and that's why it didn't happen. Then we can feel good about the decision we made and move forward.
Yeah.
So, for example, like if you didn't die of COVID and you got vaccinated and wore masks because the authorities were telling you that, that's what you needed to do, then you can assign causality to that's the, probably why I didn't die of COVID. And I'm glad that I got the vaccine and wore masks. And I think everyone else should too. Now, I'm not trying to be controversial on this. I know that's a very controversial topic. I just think it's one that has a high level of emotion. Recently, we've seen big arguments about it from the two opposing factions, the authoritarian government knows best types and the libertarian, like, no, I want my freedom types. And it's all driven around safety, right? And so the authoritarian types are like, I just want to be safe and you're endangering me with your freedom. You know, you shouldn't have freedom that endangers others. The other ones are like, look, individual liberty is the top value that we all should have, right? So those are the two sides of the coin we're talking about here. Did I do a decent job explaining?
Yeah. I think so. Danger's just, it's a tool, man. It, in our modern society, it's a tool because we don't have tigers running around in the U.S. Eating people. We eat each other now, and we do it through information and disinformation. And
well, so I wanted to talk. Yeah, so I have something that I think will tie into what you're talking about very well. And I know I'm doing a lot of talk in this episode, but
no.
So basically, I was looking at a article on Psychology Today about danger, and this was so good. It basically said, whenever we get into a situation where we perceive danger, or we're experiencing recurring anxiety in anticipation of danger, we get into what if thinking.
Hi, I'm Mark Miller, owner of Miller Furniture, your home for quality American-made furniture since 1927. I'd like to expand on Life Lab's motto, which is experiment with life, and how it relates to us as a furniture company. We're currently in our 95th year in our American furniture retail experiment. Each year, we continue to tweak and optimize what we can do for you, our valued customer. And in any experiment, you must have control groups and variables. Our control groups are, first, you must be incredibly knowledgeable about your product. And this allows you to help customers make really good home furnishing choices that they'll love for many, many years. Secondly, you must provide accurate delivery expectations when the customer is in the research and purchasing phase. And third, you must address any and all customer issues after the sale. So that's the controls. If you can't do that, you're never going to be any good at furniture retail. We've been doing this 95 years, and that is a constant, those three things. Now the fun part, the variables, things that change all the time. And I think, how can I optimize my showroom and my website so that customers love it more each and every year? Well, first, we look at different vendors. So as an independent furniture store, we have over 100 different vendors. I find new ones every single year when I go to some of the exclusive furniture markets around the country. The other important thing is, these vendors, are they equipped to provide what my customers need? So do my customers want more design options, or do they want faster delivery? Because there's often a weighing of that. If a vendor offers 100 different styles, how can you possibly be producing them quick enough? You know, maybe you only want to offer 10 styles and get them to the customer in 6 weeks instead of 6 months, those kinds of decisions. Product styles, those will always vary and evolve. We know that styles are cyclical and things come back over time, and we center around classic designs with strong staying power, because when you buy a solid hickory top or solid cherry wood Amish-made table or bedroom set, most people expect that to last 20 or 30 years, so you don't want to go too trendy. But it is important to have more trendy design options so that you have some, like, right-now appeal. Other variables are in the upholstery, your living room, your fabrics, your leathers. Those things change almost seasonally, but certainly year by year, different colors become more popular than others. We see that now with warmer neutrals coming back in style, and some of the grays and grayses that were all the rage of the past 5 years are still popular, but they're not quite where they were even 12 months ago. Now, one thing that we have is Amish-made solid wood furniture that allows us to customize the finishes. So you can make the same design look completely different just by using different wood finishes and or paints and combinations of those things. So we have looks that you just won't find in the mass-produced furniture business. Most of the furniture in this country, in the United States, is imported. The wood furniture, 88.7% of the wood furniture sold in 2019 was imported, and nearly 100% of what I show in my showrooms is American made. So we're doing things very, very different than most furniture stores you're going to find. They don't offer custom finishes on any of that mass-produced imported stuff. Plus, they're using things like Asian hardwood, rubber wood, mango, other woods that are soft and not nearly as pretty as maple or cherry or hickory, quarter sawn oak. Anyway, those are all different, the variables. The other thing is there's design-oriented customers and there's practical use customers. So if you're going to buy a kitchen table and you want to have it and it's going to be used all the time, kids are going to do homework on it, you're going to eat breakfast and dinner there, you know, that's something you might consider doing a solid hickory top with more of a medium wood finish because, one, hickory is the hardest wood, so you're not going to dent it as often. Two, a medium to light finish is going to be more forgiving. You're not going to see all those little marks. But if you're more of a design-oriented customer and you want a sleek, dark wood with a nice, clean finish, cherry or maple is going to be the wood species, and you might do a dark finish like onyx or dark night, which has a little bit of a gray undertone. So those are all the things, and that's going to be for a more design-oriented customer. Those are all the variables that are – and there's so many more. There's an endless amount of variables in the furniture retail business. And, you know, in my brick-and-mortar operation in our three St. Louis area stores, there's one additional constraint, and that's physical size. So I am in the middle of a furniture retail experiment, and I have 48,000 square feet of usable showroom space and about the same amount of warehouse space to try to figure out what's the best mix of product for my customers. And that's the experiment that I literally do every single day and that my family's been doing for four generations. And after a while, you know, you get pretty good at that kind of stuff. So we're truly experts in our field. And with the nationwide delivery capabilities that we now have, we can bring you our amazing furniture into your home so you can enjoy it for many, many years to come and hopefully decades as well. And that's going to be on millerfurniture.com. That's M-U-E-L-L-E-R furniture.com and our specific Amish furniture website called Amish Furniture Direct USA. You can also call me directly on my personal cell phone at 618-977-8716. Ask for Mark Miller, and I will be happy to have a conversation about whatever your home furnishings needs are. Thank you so much for your time, and it is an honor to sponsor Zach and Dave here on Life Lab.
So it's like, well, that is that. Now, what if? Just like when I was talking about my bridge. What if Dylan falls off that bridge? Dylan is nuts. I could see him climbing up to that edge and just hanging over the edge for fun. You know what I mean? Like, what if? And then you start assigning the probability, like, and you have this imagination thing where you're playing this through your mind, and it's obviously gets you physically worked up and scared, right? And so then you go to avoidance, right? So like, okay, well, we're definitely not going across that bridge. We're not doing it. Avoidance, right? When we're talking about the four ways you treat risk, the easiest and surest way is avoidance, right? Like the other ways, there's a much less probability of risk. But if we don't go across that bridge, he ain't falling off it. You know what I mean? Like, that's where you go. Now, here's where I'm going. And this is what ties into what you're talking about, the authoritarian versus freedom stuff. When you think that you're safe by avoiding situations, there's one thing that you're surely avoiding, and that is life experiences. Yeah.
Opportunity. Life, period.
So instead of having some small percentage chance of having a negative consequence, Dylan getting seriously injured or killed, you know, quote unquote, ruining my life, whatever, as a father for sure. There's some very small percentage chance of that. And so exchanging that if you live in fear and you're avoiding life experiences because of it, because of this danger, this perceived danger, you slowly but surely lose your life. For sure. 100% chance you lose your life. You will not have those life experiences. So what's more dangerous? When you look back on your deathbed, right, and you think of all the things that you wanted to do and you wanted to experience, but there was danger.
Yeah, I agree with your argument, but I also think if somebody has perpetually created that pattern of risk mitigation or risk avoidance throughout their life, yeah. I don't think they're the person on the deathbed thinking those thoughts. I think they're the one being like, man, I made it this long because I made my good risk avoidance choices.
I don't think
so. Either way, it doesn't matter because it ain't me. So,
well, I don't think so. But it could be someone listening. And so that's why we're talking about it. I don't think that's right. Actually, what I think is this. I think those people do end up on their deathbed. And I do think they're like, ah, I wish I would have skydived. That would have been a great experience. Yeah. I was always too fit to do it.
I can't and tell then, you. Yeah.
But here's the thing. What they may never come to is they may never come to the realization of what we're talking about.
Sure. I, as somebody that just skydived recently, and you were supposed to and didn't, there's the argument that the flip side is, oh, you got to try everything. Well, that's also a terrible argument. I don't want to try heroin. I don't want to try all kinds of other things, right? And so, like, yeah, I mean, there's just risks everywhere. There's dangers everywhere. Regrets. I don't want people to have regrets. But within your argument, I don't know. I would disagree that that person, they just seem like a very measured assessor of risk.
I don't think so, man. I think there's tons of people who on their deathbed have this bucket list of things that they didn't achieve and they regret it and they don't realize it was their own choice. They chose not to do it because they avoided danger. I think that that's absolutely true. But okay.
Yeah, Kahneman would just say that they would rationalize it.
Yeah.
There's a phrase we heard at the Bitcoin conference from Peter Thiel that I really agree with, and he says that human beings in general are insufficiently apocalyptic. Now, that's also in his business interest to say so because he supplies data analytics and information to intelligence agencies in the U.S. military about goings-on in the world of other geopolitical world powers. So it's kind of in his interest. But he was talking about Putin, and people are insufficiently apocalyptic about Putin potentially doing nuclear war, which would could lead to the annihilation of our species. And I then think, yeah, we do have the technologies and capabilities to kill everything in person on the planet. Like, those exist. That's real. Those are real facts. But I never think about those things, and I don't want to. Like, I can't control it. So again, it goes back to me. For me, it goes back to the people in control are going to use information in all they care about is growing their power, whether it's Democrats in control, Republican. There isn't a single federal government in the U.S., and I'm assuming it's this way in other countries, that isn't interested in growing their footprint of control. That's it. That's all the government does, is it constantly expands its horizons for what it wants to influence and control. And for me, they use danger or risk as an opportunity and trust. Trust us, we have the solution. But as soon as you start hearing these three things, national security, health, safety, that's the ultimate tripartite. Nobody can go against those things. Oh, you're going against national security? So as soon as I hear those three things invoked, that's when my bullshit radar goes off and I just become super skeptical personally. And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like,
and there's real, things. There's obviously, I'm not saying there's not real dangers. Like with COVID, clearly there was real dangers. Lots of people died from it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of nuance too there to what was going on, or with wars and things going on. Can I see an article of what CNN or Fox News is telling me Putin is saying at a press conference in Russian? I have no – I just totally disregard that. I don't know what he's saying. I don't speak Russian. They could be – he could be saying anything, and they're just telling me what they need us to hear.
Yeah.
And that isn't necessarily the best way to live either. As soon as I see information presented about other world powers and the decisions they're making, I immediately go, okay, the CIA wants us to think this. And I think Frank Snepp – if you haven't heard of Frank Snepp, you should – go watch a 4-minute video. He's a former CIA operative, and he just lays out very plain spokenly how they got mis and disinformation out into the media to influence how the US Congress released and appropriated monies. And that was in the 80s. So how much easier it would be now with digital media.
I agree. You know, we shared this line of thinking, so I'll agree with you 100%. Anybody listening to this now who doesn't think that you're fed misinformation to make you, you know, afraid and to act a certain way, go watch this video. It's an interview of Frank Snepp.
It's like an hour long, but there's a 4-minute clip that's already partitioned out. It's awesome.
Just watch the 4-minute version.
Yeah.
And you'll see. I mean, it's funny. It's funny too, how like if you look at that system one versus system two thinking, and we were talking about the piece that was it heuristics?
Yeah, those are the mental shortcuts we use.
The framing, because that's the one that has the stereotypes, right? So there are some real stereotypes around conspiracy theories, right? And so as soon as you start talking about something like that, where it's like, yeah, well, I mean, we know that there have been instances where the CIA and or some other three-letter agency, some government agency, we know there's instances where this has happened, and you like lay it out. People are, he's a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
That means that they equate what we're saying and telling them to watch this Frank Snepp thing as, that's like the flat earthers. That's the same.
Yeah.
He is the same as a flat earther. What, you know, because of stereotypes, people do that. You know what I mean? So I hate the idea of having certain thoughts that go against the mainstream, like the one that we're talking about now, and just being lumped into this big group of quote unquote conspiracy theorists.
But that's the thing with power. I don't think you can talk about danger without talking about power. Humans crave power. That's all we want. Every human, all we want is power, but we don't even know it because power is a feeling. You ask anyone, would you rather feel powerful or disempowered? No human on planet Earth is going to – everyone wants to feel powerful.
Well, let's bring this back to the danger conversation, because we want to have control over that situation, over that destiny, over the danger that we are exposed to.
Exactly.
You know, on that bridge situation, who was in power there, right? Really? I mean, Marin and Dylan had a limited amount of power. You know, as their father, I got to be the one who made the decision whether we went across that bridge or we didn't. Now, their power was to try to disobey me and just dart across the bridge, right? I'm bigger and faster. Would have grabbed them. Would have prevented that. But yeah, when we're talking about power and we're talking about danger, I just want to tie it back to what we're talking about in some concrete way, so people aren't like, oh, they're going off on some weird tangent. The when we're talking about authoritarian structures, they decide the danger that you are exposed to, whether you know it or not.
Well, that's the funny thing with this being insufficiently apocalyptic. Our country, if we go to horrible potential extinction level atrocities with other countries, it will be because direct actions of our country helping create the circumstances for it to get there. But it will not be framed that way up until the mass extinction, which I do not think is going to happen. I truly am optimistic of hope and love and communication and cooperation occurring. But I do believe we will have a horrible another war before this decade is out. But I believe that from that we will rise, as we always do, the phoenix from the ashes, and build better systems than we had from Bretton Woods World War II, which worked for a long time. But now they're down. They're broken. They're done. They're over. And I don't think we'll get to get past the dangers now. We have to have the clearing out, and I think that's going to come from war. I don't want it to come from war, but I don't see any other way around it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just interesting because we haven't, even though we've been at war like almost our whole lives, right? The Afghan War and what was the one before that in the 90s, the Gulf Wars. We've never seen the World War. And so I'm just curious to see how it all just be propositioned and the propaganda will be given.
One of the things that I think will one of the things that I think facilitates what you're talking about. And that is us accepting things that we may have some cognitive dissonance about, right? So we may have a little mental discomfort where we're like, oh, I don't know if that's true, but I want it to be true, right? Mm-hmm. Comforting lies. Well, you know, if you had two booths and you were selling selling them like they were baked goods, and you had comforting lies in one of the booths, and you had unpleasant truths in the other, which one do you think would sell more?
Right.
You know what I mean? The comforting lies one would be the one that sold.
Henry Kissinger is a very famous U.S. diplomat and is considered by many to be, I don't know, to have some interesting international relationships with other countries. And he's still alive and still apparently very influential through the Department of Foreign Relations. But he said something in a video of it. He said, you know, when the U.S. – he was talking to a counterpart, I believe, out of Turkey. There was some international issue going on. The guy suggested, well, why don't you just send armaments directly to the Europeans? And he said – and somebody else jumped in and yelled, and there's a transcript of this. Oh, that would be illegal. He says, when the U.S. needs to do something illegal, we act right away. When we need to do something unconstitutional, it usually takes a week. And this was the Secretary of State saying this, you know, and you don't make comments like that offhand. But to me, again, it goes back to danger and power. And let me give you a very concrete example. In Missouri, I believe anybody can conceal carry a weapon, a handgun in this state legally now without having to go through a course or training like we did. But we went through it and enjoyed it. And I have a concealed carry permit. And I couldn't tell you the last time I concealed carried until last week. We went to a spot that I just felt comfortable having a gun on me and not needing it than needing a gun and not having it. That made me feel more powerful. It made me feel safer. I felt that there was the probability for danger was higher than it normally is based on where we were going. And I had my family with me and I didn't tell any of them that I was carrying it. Now, was there any danger there once I got there? No, it was awesome. It was a great time. And I wasn't like thinking about that concealed weapon being on me, but it made me feel safer. You know, a more common scenario other folks might have. I took my son to a baseball camp last night, as did Dave. Our kids are on the same team, which is awesome. 6-year-olds playing baseball inside in this cool facility. But it was the first night for me. And so anytime there's a new behavior or new experience, there is some anxiety because you don't know what to expect. And there's almost a low level of danger, but the danger isn't physical harm. It's status harm. It's reputation. What will others think if I do something wrong or Ben doesn't wear the right thing? What are the other kids going to say? And so there's always some low level thing of that, at least for me, because I'm very conscientious of others around me. So that was interesting. But then once we got there and I saw Dave, it was just like, everything's cool.
Yeah.
But to me, that's low-level danger. So we've moved from physical harm danger to social status, reputation, connection, relationship danger.
Which is a thing, man.
Well, that's the real infection, the anxiety.
You know what? That's interesting. I like this where you're going because there's a danger. That's a much bigger danger, I think, in today's society is being – you used to get – either banished from your tribe, right? So they would literally kick you out of the walls of the village. It'd be like, good luck.
Right.
Right? So we're talking like way, way, way long ago. Then it was you were excommunicated from the church. Now you're no longer a part of the faith community. You're going to hell, right? You want to talk about danger. Nowadays, it's those things typically aren't going to happen to you.
Right.
But you will be banished or excommunicated from the tribe of, you know, the cult of personalities that you're following, right?
Right.
So it doesn't matter which one it is. You pick your poison, but go on Twitter and see which one is going to demonize you. You're going to be, you know, which group are you going to be banished from forever for having certain thoughts, beliefs, speaking a certain way? That's the danger
right.
Today that you're talking about.
Yeah, and again... And to me, it does go back to conspiracy theory. And I pulled this book off the shelf written by a guy named Rob Brotherton. It's called Suspicious Minds, Why We Believe Conspiracy Theories. And his whole point is interesting. He's like, look, yeah, there's definitely some kooks and weirdos out there, but conspiracy theories are a thing because they're a human thing. We all engage in this type of thinking because it's that system one thinking. It's that shortcut of it's easier to accept things if we can have a simple explanation that there's a small group of people plotting to make something happen rather than a much more interconnected, dependent, and complex reason for something occurring. So like in the baseball situation, it's just like, well, what if I bring him and we're late and he doesn't get to play on the good team and he has a bad experience and then he's upset and he wants to quit baseball? Or I bring him and he's wearing the wrong uniform and the kids start making fun of him and he loses self-confidence. And again, are those dangers? Again, a low level, very low level, but those are the more important ones to me than somebody showing up there or at their school with a gun, right? Is that a danger? Sure. What can we do about that? That's not a danger. We just had a shooting in St. Louis at a school. Very real now. What can we do? What can be done on this subject?
Yeah, that's important. I mean, so you've talked over the past few minutes about two real important things that I think should be called out. Number one would be like, oh, what are the statistics show versus what make us feel good?
Yeah, great point.
You know what I mean? And so obviously I grew up with firearms. I grew up learning how to shoot guns safely. I am comfortable owning guns and having them. But it's funny because I'm comfortable in a certain way where I'm comfortable taking a certain level of risk with firearms. And I notice those around me, and I know that there are people who I am friends with, and I'm not talking about you, who have a much higher risk tolerance with firearms to the point that they will be much – like they will not take the safety precautions that we take in the Ponder household with them. I have a concealed carry. I have never concealed carry. I don't know if I could say I never concealed carried, but I would just say as a rule I do not – carry. And the reason is, and whether it's true or not, I've read multiple things that talk about when you're in a situation of conflict, the presence of a firearm generally makes it a more dangerous situation rather than a less dangerous situation. That's one thing. On the flip side, there are times where I am going to a dangerous area. We live in St. Louis, right? There are definitely parts of our geography that are dangerous where I'm like, if I go there, I probably should because of the power situation. I want to have power. Yeah. I want to have that power. And that makes total sense to me. But I think it's something that should be called out.
But now it's also, do we do it at school? If I'm going up to the school, do I carry my concealed? Which right. I don't, of right. course. And we have a really good police presence at our kids' school, luckily, because several of the kids have police officers whose dads are on the force, and they always park the cars up there. So I like that. But this, to me, there is a danger here. There's a real danger. We see it across the media. Kids just go in and shoot up fucking schools.
I know.
How do we solve this problem?
Well, there's uncomfortable ways to actually solve it, and then there's the bullshit that we do that makes us feel good. The comfortable lies baked goods stand, and here's some of those. As a risk professional, I don't know. I become aware of these things. It's like when I go into a business and I see them, oh, we put in this compensating control, and it's completely worthless. And the only reason they did it is to make themselves feel good because to actually fix the problem and lower the risk for real would cost too much, right?
So what do you have a policy? Here, yeah. Like what would your policy be to stop school shootings?
Oh, yeah. We'd go like Singapore on criminal punishment. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we should do that. But I also think we should prosecute and make destitute their parents.
I don't know.
I do.
I don't know. That would stop China.
That would stop it.
But Singapore is good enough. Singapore, look at their crime rate, right?
Yeah.
And if you would have done any of this stuff in Singapore, well, nobody would be seeing you again.
Yeah.
We'll just put it that way. So, yeah, that stuff.
But we won't do that here.
Yeah.
So then what do you do?
I don't think there's an answer other than that. I don't know of another answer other than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's what we do. We lock the inner doors. So when I go pick up my kids, I can't get into the inner doors.
There's a whole industry now.
Right.
That's capitalism, right? That's sparked up for school protection and security industry.
Which is a totally, and here is the example I wanted to give. This is a totally weak and useless compensating control. Oh, those inner doors are shut. So now parents can't get in to pick up their kids at the end of the day. That's going to keep them safe. And yet, what do they do for recess? They go run around the playground out in the open where anyone could just walk on because there's no fence, there's no gate.
It's the same thing as the whole mask situation was at the beginning.
That's something that I will, say is ridiculous. We do these comfortable lies. Oh, we're putting this thing into effect. Everyone play along. This is in the name of safety.
It's not a one off. Again, it's a systematic way humans approach things. It's the story we have to tell ourselves as a collective to let us keep on being the busy bees doing whatever it is we're doing that we have no clue why we're doing it.
Yeah, you're right.
We have to have these stories of safety,
right.
I guess.
No,
but then the governments abuse. And again, this is not a political party. This is any government. A libertarian could become the president of the U.S. They would start to abuse the power.
Yes, so what I'll say is this. You hit another really important point that I'm glad we're talking about.
I've hit three today. It's
Dude,
like I'm past
good.
My quota.
You're way good.
I'm living dangerously.
You're way good. Did we hit both the other ones? One of them was statistics versus
Well, you had two. That
good.
Was the one you hit. And then you had mentioned a second one. I didn't even know what you were mentioning.
I'll have to go back and listen because I think I missed it. But the one that you're talking about now I like is we have to – there are certain things that are beyond our control that we just have to accept and move on with life because literally the Earth could get hit by an asteroid. So what are we supposed to do? We all are going to die. We're talking about danger here, right? We're talking about physical harm. You're going to die. You will die. Everyone.
Yeah.
So what are we supposed to do? Like, it's like when you go up and you look at the stars and you realize your entire life is not even a flash in the pan. You know what I mean? One twinkle in that star is your entire life. And we are worried about all this little stuff. And so my point on this is there are certain things, there are certain dangers that are just so great and so uncontrollable that we just have to accept them and move on with our lives, or else our life would just be shambles because we'd just be, oh my God, I'm going to die. The asteroid could hit us. Go look up the Titan II missile explosion. This dude dropped a wrench and it caused a nuclear explosion in a missile silo. And it could have been way worse. Could have been could have vaporized a third of the country.
Wow.
Because the dude dropped a wrench, right? So, and people, we have these and we don't even realize it. Look at the, the nuclear power plant disasters. There's any number of things. Whenever they built the Bern Super Collider, there was a chance that it would have created a black hole when they turned it on and ran their first experiment, and it would have ended Earth. The black hole would have just sucked up Earth and crushed it. And I remember reading an article where these physicists were talking about it, and they're like, yeah, it's a chance, but it's such a small chance that we're comfortable with it. And I was just like, well, who the hell are you to take that chance with all of humanity, with all of the Earth, right? Who knows what infantile percentage it was, but like, shouldn't that be a conversation everyone has and decides whether we do that or not? So anyway, there are just these dangers, these risks that you have to accept and move on, or else you're not going to live.
Yeah. I think there's first principles thinking for me. When I hear danger, I immediately go to information, trust, self-trust, trust in the information, trust in the person that's providing the information. And I go to decision-making. That for me is at the core of danger for Zach, not necessarily for everybody else. It's like, do I trust myself and my senses? Do I trust this information? Do I trust the person that's providing this information? What kind of decisions do I need to make based on this dangerous scenario or information, based on my senses, my past decisions, or what I'm trying to achieve? And then can I accept the consequences? And to me, I can't talk about those things without differentiating between secrecy and privacy. We haven't mentioned this very much, but this is a huge part of danger, especially when you're talking governments and business. And if you've never So governments are always going to come out and want to protect their secrets, right? Secrets are things we don't want anybody to know. Privacy is different, but they want to act like it's the same thing and use that as a tool to hit you on the head with it, to make you feel like things that you're doing in private are secretive as citizens, and that's shameful. Mm-hmm. There is an awesome
good movie, The Circle.
The Circle, there's a I would suggest reading literally a 5-minute article called A Cypherpunk's Manifesto by Eric Hughes. Very famous, very brief 5-minute read article talking about the difference between secrecy and privacy and how governments kind of abuse this. And
I'll extend it to just organizations.
Organizations, yeah. Yes. But if you – that's the whole adage, like, oh, there's no day. I don't have anything to hide. They can look. Okay, cool. Live without drapes. Don't put drapes in your home.
Right.
Right. There's a huge difference, and I know you already get this, but a lot of people don't think through it. If my change challenge is go read A Cypherpunk's Manifesto by Eric Hughes, literally 5-minute read, really important information there. And he probably doesn't mention the word danger, but as our world becomes more apocalyptic, which is occurring, if you're not paying attention, we have trade wars going on, technology wars, economic wars, currency wars. Internal disruption in the United States and in China is at levels that it hasn't been since Vietnam War. Kinetic wars, Ukraine, Russia, geopolitical alliance forming. The only thing left is a hot war, a kinetic war between major world powers. That's the only one that's not on the table.
Right.
And a lot of people think that that's where we're moving.
Well, it's escalating with Russia, and China is supporting Russia, and so we're supporting Ukraine.
So I think it's important to re-familiarize yourself with the difference between secrecy and privacy, because I think that'll be a tool that'll be used against citizens around the world, not just U.S. But you can't – they're going to talk about danger and secrecy. Well, we can't disclose all this stuff. It's secrets. It's
for your own good.
It's national security secrets.
It keeps us safe. Can't have people knowing that.
Yeah. So again, with me, the conspiracy piece, whenever I hear that, a small group of people plotting to do things that are harmful or illegal, that's what a conspiracy is. That to me is not a conspiracy. That's just how a government's run. That's how it is. Yeah. If I was a member of government, I'm sure I'd be doing everything possible to expand my power purview just like they all do. No one wants to operate a government like the dude from Parks and Rec, which is how I'd like to, Ron Swanson. You know, I'll fire myself to reduce the size of the government's footprint. Like, people don't do that,
right.
which is great.
Right.
But I also just believe in keeping on, keeping on. And it's like, identify the dangers that exist for me and my family. Most of those are those social status comparison anxiety level dangers. And in terms of a nuclear war, biological, chemical, cyber, crazy stuff I can't control, just know that, hey, live life every day to the fullest.
So I've got a change challenge that's at the individual level, that is a tactic that you can use to deal with anxiety that pops up for danger.
Ooh, awesome.
So let me give mine. But before I do, let me see if I can't try to summarize what the framing of what you're talking about with danger and safety when it comes to large organizations, especially governments, but large organizations. This can be applied to – you can just pull it out. It can be applied to religions. It can be applied to universities.
Corporations,
for sure. All of these things happen in organizations with power, and it all centers around power. And the way I'll tie it back to danger is basically two lines of thinking. And Ray Dalio does a good job of explaining these lines of thinking about two different governments, the United States government and what it was founded on, and the Chinese government and what their values are and how they think and what they're founded on. And so historically, not to say that we're staying true to this, but historically, the United States was founded on, and our value, our highest value, are individual freedoms. The ability to choose for ourselves, make our own way, you know, that's the American way, right? Freedom. That's why we celebrate the 4th of July and all that. On the flip side, the Chinese government is completely the opposite. They are paternalistic. Daddy government will keep you safe. Daddy government makes all the decisions, makes all the rules, so you don't have to worry about it. And that's the way that it should be. Now, it's interesting because there is a spectrum between those two things. And every organization and their policies and the way that they yield their power and hoard power and share power falls somewhere on that spectrum. And when you're thinking about danger and safety, and you're making a decision whether you are going to try to take the reins and make the decision for yourself and take the responsibility for that decision versus giving up that the responsibility of that decision because there's danger there and I just want to be kept safe by daddy, organization, whoever, right? Just understand you're doing that. Make a conscious, you know, decision. Oh, I am actually giving away control of this because I feel safety. I'm doing this for safety reasons, right?
Yeah.
I think that's important. Okay. So that's all on Zach's side of this house. What I'll say about danger is this. We experience anxiety in our modern culture way more than we should. It's the reason why there's, you know, Xanax and all this, you know, therapists are going gangbusters. It's clear. All the statistics show we've got anxiety.
We've never
left
had the
right.
ability to be more connected and feel more alone at the same time.
So I think that there are some tactics that we need, right? Recognize whenever you're practicing that what if thinking that I talked about earlier. What if this happens? What if that happens? Oh, I better not do that, this, because what if, right? Recognize when you're doing that. And when you start to do that, instead of the what if thinking, switch over and start to what is thinking. Confront the thoughts that you're having about the what if and say, okay, well, that what if scenario isn't happening right now. And then state what happening is. I'm getting ready to go to the store. I am opening my front door. I am driving in my car. I'm sitting, reading. I am breathing, right? And that should bring a little bit of calm, at least to take control of the situation in which you're feeling anxiety. What is?
That's cool. I like it.
And then I'll say this. Then to protect against that from being a recurring situation, it's the old one that it's so valuable. And it's free to do. And I don't know why it's so hard to do, but it's meditate.
Yep.
Just sit. Focus on your breathing. Tell yourself, in this breath, I'm okay. Everything that happens, label it. Accept it. And just, I think that's it. Acceptance, right?
Just clear your mind.
Acceptance. You know, when we talked about, it's so funny, we talked about risk treatments. And I think that that's an important thing to think about because I always think about it in the context of business. But thinking about it in the context of life, acceptance is huge, right? Like, we can't control that an asteroid might hit the Earth. That might happen while we're alive, you know? Every once in a while, there's a news story about, oh, this one's tracking. Oh, my God. And there are a dozen or two dozen, there's probably 100 other like scenarios that we are accepting whether we want to or not, whether we recognize it or not. And we don't fret about those. Why would you? It would just give your life away. So why do you fret about the ones that are a little bit more down the line, that are sure they're a little bit more probable, right? But for sure you're giving your life away by fretting about them. So there is a time for acceptance. You are accepting risk all the time, whether you know it or not. You are accepting danger
life
all
the time.
Life
is risk.
Yes. So take one of these things that you're freaking out about, right? Like, oh, I don't want to, you know, drive to this area, or that road is too dangerous, or so many deaths on it. Whatever it is you're freaking out about, whatever that is, just understand, are you willing to give up that experience of your life, that part of your life, in order to avoid that? Or should you just accept it and move on?
A smaller danger. I got the holiday coming up, Thanksgiving. I don't like being with the family. We got the uncle that does this, talks politics or this or that. Low level danger.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about
modify
that.
Modify yourself.
What if
change
uncle,
yourself whatever. To be yeah. the world that you want to see, be peaceful, be calm, be kind, see what happens.
I love it.
Nice. Love it. Well, we've talked about a lot here, man. Those were great. I got your change challenges written down.
Great.
We've talked about primal thinking. We've talked about intelligent thinking, system one, system two. We've talked about danger morphing from being chased by enemies and animals to being chased by anxieties and social comparisons. We've talked about the relationship between power and control always operating in the background. We've talked about the idea for authorities using power and crises, safety, health, and security as tools to control people. The relationship between information, disinformation, decision-making, danger. There's been a lot that we've covered here, and Dave hit it best, I think. There's danger can be sort of like a dial, and there's different degrees of danger. And if you're always turning your dial up, what you're doing is turning your quality of life down. So just make sure life's an experiment. If you already knew the outcome of the experiment, it wouldn't be worth living. Like, you need to have a little danger in that experiment. So as we say at Life, experiment with life.